Please be seated. Well, again, welcome everyone this morning. It is a beautiful day outside. It's hot. And again, it's so great that we all have the ability to come and gather here, even when Pastor Brian's not here, that we can all gather and the fellowship still goes on. We're still able to teach. We're still able to gather in his name. And I just thank you guys all for being part of that. That really means a lot to all of us. And I think it says a lot about our fellowship here. So, as always, the doors have been locked from the outside until I finish. So, yeah. So we're going to start and we're going to finish today in Romans 8:28. And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. And as I studied this, I realized that I have a lot of issues with how the world looks at this verse and even how we as Christians use this verse sometimes. And we're going to unpack a little bit of that today and make sure that we're looking at it in the concept that God wants us to look at it. And to really understand this verse, there's really no better place to look than going all the way back to Genesis and looking at Joseph. And looking at what he went through in his life, what he accomplished in his life, and ultimately what God's purpose was for him in his life, as it pertains to this verse, as it pertains to what God's use was for him, for his family, for his descendants. It's really a remarkable chain of events that, and how he handled it is just like no one else. He's probably one of only a couple of people in the Bible that the Bible doesn't really say anything bad about him. And that's a big deal, especially at the time that he lived in. And as we go through this today, I want everybody to think about what you have in common with Joseph. What do you share with him? What traits do you share with him? What circumstances in your life do you maybe share with him? Because there's just so many things that we're going to unpack in here today that apply to what we go through each and every day in our lives. And there's going to be a test at the end, but I'll give you the answers, so don't worry. But just think about that. What do you have in common with him? Because there's a couple of things that really, really stand out that you'll see as we go through this. But to really jump in and understand who Joseph was and the importance of this account in the Bible. I don't like to say story because that makes it sound fake. The Bible's real, folks, so this is a historical account, so let's call it what it is. We have to go back really far. We have to look at his family, you know, and what he came out of that. You know, Joseph is somebody who was, you're going to see he's happy pretty much all the time. He's always able to find the good in different situations that he finds himself in. And the world really looks down on people like that. You ever have people in your lives where you're just like, I can't stand how happy they are all the time. It's like, just get angry once in a while. We see people like that. The world mocks people like that. You know, they make TV shows and cartoon characters like that that are designed to be a joke and be made fun of. But the reality of it is that's kind of how God wants us to be. So it's a little bit backwards. But you're going to see, despite all these things, he never really complains, never blames anybody for anything, never questions his circumstances, but he's got every reason to do that, okay? So, starting with his family, they were nuts. That's the translation that I have here in the, no. But they really were. Now, we've spent a lot of time talking about Jacob, who his own name meant the deceiver. And we spent a lot of time going through many months ago over the things that Jacob went through, the way he tried to bargain with God, the way his uncle just tried to swindle each other out of everything for all these years. And Jacob gets caught up in the middle of that. And when Jacob's father sent him to go find a wife from Laban's family, that's where we're going to pick up the story here in Genesis chapter 29, verse 15. Laban said to Jacob, "Because you are my relative, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me, what should your wages be?" Well, Jacob had already met Rachel, Laban's daughter, by this point. And the Bible tells us here that Rachel was beautiful in form and appearance. Now, our God does not concern himself with looks physically. So whenever the Bible goes out of its way to tell us that somebody was extraordinarily good looking, it probably means something bad's going to happen to them. There's a reason we tell us that, okay? He's already met Rachel by this point. And the first thing he did when he met Rachel, he realized who she was. He runs up to her and he kisses her. She's the most beautiful thing he's ever seen. Wow, look at her. Okay. Now, Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. So he met the younger daughter. Leah's eyes were delicate. That's Hebrew for she wasn't much to look at. Okay? And again, God's going out of his way to tell us about someone's physical appearance here. So that's going to be an indicator that something's going to happen here. Now, Jacob loved Rachel, so he said, I will serve you 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter. And Laban said, it is better that I give her to you than that I should give her to another man. Stay with me. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed only a few days to him because of the love he had for her. He loves her so much. He works for Laban for 7 years, and they go by like that. He doesn't care about the time because he knows he's going to get the woman that he loves as his wife at the end of it. That's a courtship, folks. Okay? So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed only a few days to him because of the love he had for God. So Jacob said to Laban, give me my wife, for my days are fulfilled, that I may go into her. And Laban gathered all the men of the palace together and made a feast. Now it came to pass in the evening that he took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to Jacob, and he went into her. So imagine this, men. You get married, your wife's behind a veil, so you don't see her face. That's what would have happened here. Also, this story is, it indicates that they were pure throughout that 7 years. He's never been with Rachel. He's never seen her in their bedroom or anything like that. She's behind a veil when they get married. They go into their wedding suite at night. They go into that tent. It's dark. They don't see anything. And then you wake up in the morning. He's expecting Rachel, and he sees Leah. Whoa! It's going to freak him out a little bit, right? But and now, right away, what's happening here? This shouldn't be a surprise to Jacob. This is the same thing he did to his father with his brother Esau. It's now being done to him. And now he is going to face the consequences of that all over again. So Laban gave his maid Zilpah to his daughter Leah as a maid. So it came to pass in the morning, behold, it was Leah. And he said to Laban, what is this you have done to me? Was it not Rachel that I served you? Why have you deceived me? So you have the guy whose name means the deceiver complaining about being deceived. And he's done this to so many different people over the years, and he's going to continue to do it to Laban over the next few years. And Laban said, well, it must not be done so in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. Would have been great to know that 7 years ago, wouldn't it? Yeah. Fulfill her week, and we will give you this one also for the service which you serve with me still another 7 years. So what does Jacob do? He does so. He fulfills her week, and then he takes Rachel as his wife also. So now here we go. Now he's got two wives who are sisters, who are also his cousins. Okay. And Laban gives his maid Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as a maid. So now there's four women wrapped up in this story already and one guy. Now Jacob also went into Rachel, but he loved Rachel more than Leah, and he served with Laban another 7 years. So this is going to set off a chain of events here that is going to put Jerry Springer to shame with any episode that he could come up with from his show. Okay, this is the Real Housewives of Canaan here, what you're going to see here. These two sisters are going to, for all intents and purposes, become mortal enemies with one another. And it's going to set off a chain of events where, at the end of this, you're going to have four mothers with 12 sons with one father, being Jacob. These women basically enter into a baby-making contest where God sees that Jacob loves Rachel more. So what does he do? It says right here, he closes her up so she can't have children. And Leah produces children. Well, then Rachel gets jealous, so she says, well, fine, here's my maid, have a child with her. Well, that worked out really well when Sarah and Abraham did it. Okay, the Jewish people are still paying for that. So why not repeat that again? And Jacob knew. He had to have known, but he didn't think about any of these things. He knew the scriptures by that. Or I didn't say the scriptures weren't written, but he knew his family's oral history at that point. He would have known what happened with Sarah and Abraham. So we have all these women now. They're going to have these 12 sons of Jacob here. And what's going to happen is this is going to be the origin of a nation, folks. This is the root of Israel taking place right here with these 12 sons. These 12 sons, and by the way, each of these 12 sons, the Bible goes into detail and gives us, and for time purposes, I'm not going to go through every one of them, but it's a fantastic account to read. It gives us the circumstances that every one of Jacob's sons was born under. And each of their names is named after basically awkward circumstances. You see it as you read through here. God has judged my case, and he heard my voice and gave me a son. Therefore, she called him Dan. With great wrestling, I have wrestled with my sister. Indeed, I have prevailed, so I have not called him Naphtali. A troop comes, so she called him Gad. Each one of these was one sister or one maid trying to one-up the other one and say, well, I've got a baby now. Well, I've got a baby now. They went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth until there was 12 sons between them. And these are 12 sons that all have daddy issues, okay? There's animosity between them because of the circumstances of their mothers. Their mothers don't like each other very much, and that's going to be passed down to children, okay? This is the origin of a nation. And I'm going to paraphrase this, but Winston Churchill described the nation of Israel as an indistinguishable wandering tribe. But they grasped this idea that nobody else could grasp. They grasped the truths in the concepts that were revealed by God. And that's an interesting thought to think about here, because they did, even despite all of this craziness here, God blessed this family despite all of this. And we're going to talk about that later on as we go through this. God doesn't bless us or call on us based on what we've done. He calls on us based on what he knows that we are capable of doing and what he's given us to do. And we're going to see that. And that's a great picture of the nation of Israel there. But so the first takeaway, there's going to be four different takeaways that we have as we go through this. But the first should be just looking at this family here. How often do we blame our family for how we are? We do that, don't we? We say, oh, I'm this way because my dad didn't hug me enough, or I'm this way because of the way my grandfather treated me, or I'm this way because my dad wasn't there, or I'm this way because my mom wasn't there. We blame our family for our circumstances very frequently. We all have that, you know. Everybody says, oh, every family's got that one crazy person in it, right? Well, this family is a whole family of crazy people. We're going to see that here. But we do. We blame our families. And it's interesting to think about. I mean, look around at the world nowadays and the things that we do at New Hope when we minister to families there. We do. We get in people there that the reason they're there for our help is because they didn't have a father, or they came from a very broken home, and it's created circumstances in their lives. And we're going to see as you go through these accounts here what these family circumstances did. I mean, these brothers, they grew up. Some of them were savages. I mean, they grew up, they were murderers. They were very deceitful. They were very hateful with the way that they solved problems with one another. And that comes as a result of having this broken family. When you've got a man with four wives here, this isn't when you turn on this TV and see sister wives, you know, and you see the Mormon father with eight different wives and they're supposed to be one big happy family. That's not how it works. It certainly not how it worked here. It created this family of people all wanting dad's love and dad's affection. The kids all wanted it. The wives all wanted it. And it created just for this volatile mix of people that led to sons that were murderous. And you're going to see that as how they solved some of these problems as they went on. So that's the family that Joseph was born into here. His family was mixed. It was very broken. It was contentious as they went on to things. And again, for time, I would love to spend weeks just going through this with what I only have today. So we're going to skip ahead a little bit, and we're going to focus now on Joseph. So Joseph is 17 years old now, and we're going to go to chapter 37. Him and his brothers are grown. Joseph is the second to the youngest, so his brothers are, they're all adults now. And it says, Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. This is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers. And this lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah. Now, these are the servants of his father. So again, you also have to think with those particular sons, so there's animosity between them and the sons of Rachel and Leah and vice versa. Each of them thinks their mother has some claim that the other one doesn't have. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. He was a tattletale. That's basically what this is telling us here. OK, okay? And it says Israel, now God has renamed Jacob Israel by this point, loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a tunic of many colors. So he made him a special robe. You've all seen the play, the Technicolor Dreamcoat thing. Well, the significance of this is it would have been very expensive. You know, those dyes that they used to make those things, the purple dyes especially, that's why kings always wore purple. It was very expensive to get your hands on that stuff. So if he made him a coat of many colors, it would have been a tremendous favor. It would have been very, very expensive. And his brothers saw that their father loved him more than his brothers, and they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Imagine that. Have you ever disliked somebody so much that you couldn't even speak to them? You couldn't even be in the same room as them? We've probably all been there at some point. Have you ever disliked somebody so much with a thought of physically harming them comes into your head? These are sinful thoughts that come into our minds. But the idea to dislike somebody that much that you think about physically harming them, maybe even killing them, enters your mind even briefly. That's what Joseph's brothers thought of him. And those are scary thoughts. Those are very sinful, very, very wicked thoughts. But these are the thoughts that they had for him. And now Joseph's going to do something that it's not his own doing. Not his own doing. Something's going to happen here that's going to make them dislike him even more. Joseph had a dream and he told it to his brothers and they hated him even more. That's a good rule to live by. If you have a dream about somebody, probably keep it to yourself. Because a lot of times it's kind of creepy, you know, it might reveal some line of thinking, but it is. Probably keep it to yourself. But God does this throughout the Bible. He reveals things through dreams to people. And Joseph is one of only a couple of people in the Bible that is given the gift, or God uses him as a vessel to interpret dreams. We see it here, and we're going to see it. We see it later on with Daniel. But the Bible also does a very good job of distinguishing between dreams and visions, especially in the book of Genesis. And it's clear here that what Joseph has here is a dream. It says, "There we were binding sheaves in the field, and then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And indeed, your sheaf stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf." And his brothers said to him, "Shall you indeed reign over us, or shall you indeed have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and his words. We're already jealous of this guy. Dad loves him more. Dad made him that nice coat. He's the baby. Everybody loves him. And now he's telling us he's going to rule over us someday. So he's not done there, though. He dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Look, I've dreamed another dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me." So he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream that you've dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come bow down to earth before you?" Now your mother and I are going to bow down to you too? What's going on here? And this is all the interpretation it gives us of these dreams. And we're going to see, we see it come to fruition later, but they don't know what this means. And it's not Joseph's doing. He didn't go and have this dream. He didn't go and make up this dream. God gave him this dream, and he innocently turned around and told it to his brothers. He's done nothing wrong to this point. And then we see later on, his brothers went to feed their father's flock. And as Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come and I will send you to them." So he said, "Here I am." Joseph again, he's happy, he's all the time, he's so upbeat about everything. And he said to them, "Please go and see if it is well with your brothers and the flocks, and bring back word to me." So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem. And now a certain man found him, and there he was wandering the field. And as the man asked him, saying, "What are you seeking?" So he said, "I'm seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks." And the man said, "They have departed from here, for I have heard them say, 'Let's go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers. So they're out working the fields. Now when they see him far off, it says, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. Again, wicked thoughts. This goes back to that broken family. If that's the kind of broken family you're raised in, it stands to reason that this is probably how they resolve conflict. We have the problem, let's just end the problem. We don't want to deal with Joseph. We're so jealous of him. It would be better if he weren't here. You don't get that type of attitude in a stable home. That's why that family life of his is so important. They had that kind of hate and contempt in their heart, and it was just natural to them. Let's just kill him. And so they said, look, the dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us kill him, cast him into some pit, and we shall say, some wild beast devoured him, and we'll see what becomes of his dreams. They were afraid. I think there was a part of them that probably understood what that dream meant, and they were afraid of it. They were afraid of bowing down someday to this younger brother of theirs that they couldn't even speak to peaceably because they hated him so much. So they said, let's kill him. Now, Reuben is the one brother with some reason here. He says, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness. Do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of the hands and bring him back to his father. So Reuben's thinking to himself, let's just throw him into a pit and leave him. I'm going to come back later, and I'm going to rescue him. So it came to pass, when Joseph had come to his brothers, they stripped him of his tunic of many colors that was on him. So he shows up wearing this bright coat that dad made him. His brothers are upset. They're jealous of him. They hate this thing. So they took him, and it says, then they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty, and there was no water in it. The very next verse says, they sat down to eat a meal. These guys are wicked. Can we all just agree that this is screwed up? These guys are wicked. They threw their brother into a pit. It says clearly that there's no food, there's no water. He's probably in there screaming for his life. He has no idea why this has happened. He's screaming, begging for help. They're sitting there having lunch. That's their background entertainment. This is really, really wicked stuff. Then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there's a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing spices, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry them down to Egypt. Now Judah is one of the brothers here that the Bible goes into a lot of detail to tell us just how bad this guy was. He was probably one of the worst of all of them. He thinks to himself, what profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? How can we make something out of this? Let's not just kill him, let's sell him. Then we can at least go home with our pockets a little bit more full, right? Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not a hand be upon him. He is our brother and our flesh. And his brothers listened. They followed Judah's lead. Now, Reuben is probably gone at this point. Reuben doesn't know this is happening, because we're going to see later, Reuben's going to come back thinking he's going to rescue Joseph out of the pit, and he's going to be gone. So we don't know where Reuben is at this point, but Judah has taken the lead, said, hey, let's get rich off of this. So the Midianite traders passed by. The brothers pulled Joseph and lifted him out of the pit and sold him. So they threw him in a pit, they pull him out of the pit, and they turn around and they sell him. And then Reuben's going to come back. He returned to the pit, and indeed Joseph was not there, and he tore his clothes. And he returned to his brothers and said, the lad is no more, and I, where shall I go? So they took the Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, and they dipped the tunic in the blood. They sent the tunic of many colors as they brought it to their father and said, we have found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not? So now they're trying to play dumb. Obviously they know whose it is. And they know that Jacob is going to know whose it is. And he recognized it and said, it is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces. Imagine that as a parent. You know any one of your kids. Let it be, it says here, the one that he loved more than the others. It's his favorite. Torn to pieces. Imagine going through that. So he's going to, and Jacob is going to go years living with this. That's a very heavy weight to carry around. So now point number two, we talked about, do we blame our family for the circumstances in our lives? What about others? Do we blame others for the circumstances in our lives? See, all of this happened to Joseph out of jealousy. That's the root of what happened here, what his brothers did. But we see these dreams taking place here, and we know that those dreams came from God. So we see God's hand at work here. And I have to point out here, too, be very careful with dreams. You know, the Bible talked about dreams a lot, revealing them to people, but I really believe that nowadays we have to be very careful with that. The Bible is complete, okay? This is something that Joseph and his brothers didn't have, that nobody had in that time. We have this, and it's finished. Jesus finished it on the cross for us and then gave us this Bible that we have everything. So if you have, you know, if we have thoughts like that, if we think that God is coming to us and revealing things to us in dreams, well, we should always be seeking clarity here first. And if you find it here, that's between you and God. But if you don't find it here, that's something to be skeptical of. It's definitely something to pray about. That's why I really love that the Bible does such a good job of distinguishing when something is a dream, when something is a vision. God doesn't want us getting caught up in that stuff. He doesn't want us getting caught up in trying to decipher these things because he gave us all the answers already right here. That's where we should be going. So do we blame our family for our circumstances? Do we blame others for our circumstances? Joseph doesn't. At no point did he say, you know, at no point are we going to see that he blames his family for any of this. He's just going to go on doing what he does. He doesn't blame anybody else. He doesn't blame jealousy or anything. And he's now sold into Egypt. And we pick him up in chapter 39, where Joseph is taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of the Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites. And right away, we're told the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now, don't get hung up on that word success and think that everything was just great for Joseph now. He's pulled out of the pit. He's sold. Oh, but now he's successful. He's in Potiphar's house. He's the leader of Egypt. This is not pain-free. He's still not a free man. He's living in bondage. For all intents and purposes, he is a slave. So what does he do? Does he say, why am I stuck here? How do I get out of this place? Maybe I can buy my way out. Maybe I can bargain my way out. He doesn't do any of those things. He doesn't do any of those things. He goes on and he works and he does what he does and God blesses him. And his master saw that saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord made all he did prosper in his hand. I have prayed that so many times personally, just thinking about my own job or jobs I've had over the years, that Lord, just bless the work of my hands like you did with Joseph. And what's happening here is God isn't blessing Potiphar. He's blessing Potiphar's house for Joseph's sake. Be very clear on that, okay? But that's such an inspiring thought. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. And then he made him overseer of his house and all that he put under his authority. He's in charge of Potiphar's house. It says that, you know, at one point it talks about when Joseph is in charge of these things that he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. The only thing he was concerned about was what was in his hand right now. Joseph was in charge of everything in this house. And that's an interesting thought. We're going to jump ahead. I want to jump ahead real quick to Jeremiah chapter 11. For I know the thoughts that I think towards you, says the Lord, thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you a future and a hope. God gave this prophecy to Jeremiah very early on in the Israelites' captivity in Babylon. And what God is saying to them here is the same thing that was going on with Joseph here. He's saying, whatever the circumstances are in your life, while you're sitting around waiting for everything to be perfect, get comfortable because you're going to be there for a while. They were going to be there for 70 years, and God gave them that prophecy. He's saying, get comfortable. You're going to be here a while. Buy a house, get a job, maybe invest a little bit of money, have a family, but get comfortable. You're not going anywhere. It's going to be a while. The biggest thing we're going to come out of Joseph's story here is the concept of God's timing and just how absolutely perfect it is. So while we're waiting around for things in our lives to be perfect, what God is really calling us to do is exactly what Joseph did here. Do what you do. Do your job. Live where you live. Whatever you're called to do, do it. That's what Joseph did here. He didn't complain. He didn't try and get out. He didn't try and bargain his way out. He just went on and did what he did. Then it says here, now we get the big warning. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. We get another one of those warnings about looks. That means something is going to happen here. And it came to pass, after all these things, that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph. So this is Potiphar's wife. And she's very subtle. She says to Joseph, lie with me. I'm going to try that one on your wives later, husbands. See how that works out for you. She's very subtle. Lie with me. You have to hear, if you know who Pastor Ken Graves is from Calvary Chapel in Maine, he's got the voice of a Viking. And when he says this, it's like, I think if she sounded like that, I probably would have ran away. But it's to just come up and be so direct like that. She's not subtle at all. So what if, but now that... Again, this is the such a remarkable thing about Joseph. He refused and said to his master's wife, "Look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand." He's resisting her. This is 3,500 years before Charlton Heston delivered the Ten Commandments, folks, and Joseph is recognizing sin. He's recognizing sexual immorality. We've been studying that. We studied that in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 last week. What did we settle on? That any sexual activity outside of marriage is immoral. And Joseph is recognizing that. This is hundreds of years before the law of God was given, and Joseph is recognizing sin. "There is no one greater in the house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me, but because you are his wife, and how can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" He understands that it's a sin against God's law, and God hasn't even given that law yet. That is faith. That is faith right there. "So it was, as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed to her or lie with her or to be with her." He wouldn't even be alone around her. He was following the Billy Graham rule, folks. He didn't even want to be alone with her because it made him so uncomfortable. And that is just an overwhelming recognition of sin, of sexual immorality, of God's law, and of just showing respect to his master. "But it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of that house was inside. She caught him by his garment and said, 'Lie with me.' But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside." So if you're keeping score at home, that's the second time Joseph's coat has gotten him in trouble. Okay? "And so it was when she saw that he had left his garment and fled outside, she called to the men of the house and spoke to them, saying," now this woman, this is where we're going to see how evil this woman is. She's already tried to seduce Joseph. "He has brought into us a Hebrew to mock us." She's talking about her husband. She gets all the men of the house together, and she's bad-mouthing her husband in front of all of them. "He has brought a Hebrew into mock us. He came in to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And it happened when he heard that I lifted my voice and cried out that he left his garment with me and fled and went outside." This is evil. She's blaming her husband for something that Joseph didn't even do. "Then she spoke to him with words like these, saying, 'The Hebrew servant whom you brought into us, you brought into us, came in to mock me.'" Potiphar, all he did was purchase Joseph out of slavery. He hasn't even done anything wrong here. And now something very curious happens. "When his master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, saying, 'Your servant did to me after this manner,' he was angry. But it says, 'Joseph's master took him and put him in the prison in the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison.'" I personally find it very curious that Potiphar didn't just kill Joseph. He had it well within his authority to just say, "Off with his head, let's be done with this guy. You tried to rape my wife, you're out of here." But none of that happened. And I think that's so unique, and I think that shows God's hand at work here. But I think it also says that Potiphar may not have completely trusted his wife. We've all said that, right? If somebody's going to, we've all given that advice to other people in relationships. Well, if somebody's going to cheat on you, it's probably because they've done it before. Or if they've cheated on somebody else, they'll cheat on you. Well, it's probably not the first time this has happened. So I don't think he completely trusted his wife to begin with. "And it says, 'The Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. The keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's authority because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper." So what do you wish was different in your life? Joseph is a slave in Egypt, He goes into this house where he just works. He just goes about it. He doesn't complain. And he just said, wherever I am, I'm going to serve the Lord. Isn't that a great thing to think about? Honor the Lord wherever you are, whatever your circumstances are, whatever's going on in your life, whatever uphill battle you're facing. I don't care if it's personal. I don't care if it's health. I don't care if it's financial. I don't care if it's a job related or based on other people. Wherever you are sitting right now, serve the Lord. That's the lesson that we're getting from this. See, we justify things by blaming God. God abandoned me. God let this happen to me. God's forgetting about me. Well, no, because in Matthew 28:20, God says, I am with you always, even until the end of the age. And it tells us here, he was with Joseph throughout all these things. He was with him, just like he's with us. My Bible says always. As my old pastor would say, he'd be like, check your Bibles. Do you say sometimes? Do you say I'm with you for most things? Does yours say I'm with you for just the kind of hard things, but not the really hard things? No, it says I'm with you always. And always for me means always. He's with you. I don't care what you're going through right now. He's there. And he's holding your hand, and he wants to lead you through it. And we're going to see here in a few moments that it's because he has a calling for you and he has a purpose for you. We aren't through with Joseph yet, because now he's been thrown into prison. And I don't even say he's gotten himself thrown into prison, because Joseph didn't do anything to get himself thrown into prison. He was thrown into prison because of the actions of what Potiphar did, or his wife did. And it came to pass after these things that the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt offended their lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief butler and the chief baker. And it doesn't tell us why, but I find it interesting. Why would you throw the butler and the baker in prison? Well, what do the butler and the baker have access to at the hands of the king? His food. So it's a healthy assumption to me. There was probably an assassination attempt against the Pharaoh. And he looked at the two of them and said, somebody probably tried to poison him. And they said, this had to have come from one of you two. In the prison you go. So he put them in the custody in the house of the captain of the guard in the prison, the place where Joseph was confined. And the captain of the guard charged Joseph with them, and he served them. So they were in custody for a while. So what does Joseph do? He's in prison now. Does he immediately fall to his knees and pray to God to let him out of prison? This is thousands of years before God is shaking down prison walls and letting Paul out of prison. So that thought doesn't even cross his mind. He knows his way around. He's given charge of everything. Does he try and launch an escape? He had it well within his authority to do it, but it doesn't tell us that it even crossed his mind. He focuses on the Lord, and he does what he does. He just does his work. He says, this is where I am. This is the circumstances. So I'm just going to serve God here. So then the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt were confined in the prison, had a dream. Both of them, each man's dream in one night, and each man's dream with its own interpretation. So now we're going to see that annoyingly positive Joseph from their point of view here. And Joseph came to them in the morning and looked at them, and he saw that they were sad. If you're in prison, it's probably already the worst day of your life. Joseph sees that they're sad. So what does he do? He walks up and says, why do you look so sad today? It's exact in verse 7. It says, why do you look so sad today? And they said to him, we have each had a dream, and there is no interpreter of it. So Joseph said to them, don't interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me, please. So the chief butler told his dream to Joseph and said to him, behold, my dream, a vine was before me, and the vines were three branches. And it was though it budded, its blossoms shot forth, and its clusters brought forth ripe grapes. The Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes, and I pressed them into Pharaoh's cup, and placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. And Joseph said to him, this is the interpretation of it. The three branches are 3 days. Now within 3 days, the Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your place. And you will put Pharaoh's cup in his hand, according to the former manner when you were his butler. What we're going to see next here, this is the first indication we're going to get that Joseph sees an opportunity to change his circumstances. It's really the first and only indication we ever see And it's a fairly simple one. He says, remember me when it's well with you, and please show kindness to me. Make mention to me of Pharaoh and get me out of this house. He says, hey, wait. He's going to restore you in 3 days. Don't forget about me. Tell the Pharaoh, hey, there was this guy there. He interpreted this dream. We need to get him out of here. You can use him. Because remember, the Pharaohs were surrounded by, we see that in Exodus, the Pharaohs were surrounded by wise men and by enchanters and sorcerers, as they put it. You know, and this was all sleight of hand. Some of it may have been demonic, but they surrounded themselves with people like this as counselors to solve their problems. So, hey, don't you want a guy that can interpret dreams? Joseph sees that opportunity, and he tries to capitalize on it. Well, then next, you have the chief baker. He's going, ooh, I had a dream too. I had a dream too. You got good news for me? I also was in my dream, and there were 3 white baskets on my head. And the uppermost basket were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh, and the birds ate them out of my basket on my head. That's got to be good news for me, right? Joseph doesn't even wait. He doesn't try and change the subject. You know, he doesn't say, let me sleep on that one. He just jumps right in. Says, this is the interpretation of it. The 3 baskets are 3 days. Within 3 days, the Pharaoh will lift off your head from you and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh from you. Lift off your head. I don't know how that happens, but... And it's exactly what happened. It came to pass on the 3rd day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast for his servants, and he lifted up the head of the chief butler and the chief baker among his servants. He restored the chief butler to his butlership and placed his cup in the Pharaoh's hand, but he hanged the chief baker as Joseph had interpreted. So is the chief baker found to be guilty? Again, the Bible doesn't tell us this stuff, but history gives us some good things that we can possibly speculate that. But again, it's only speculation. Please don't write that down. Joseph is in prison now. Again, he's put in a position of authority, and he's given these unique circumstances, but he's still in prison. Again, as we said, it's not pain-free. It's prison. He's away from his family. He's been away for years at this point. And what we're ultimately going to see is this is going to come to fruition in his story, but it's going to take, he's going to be away 13 years away from his family since he was thrown into that pit. And what does he show during that time? Well, the Bible calls it patient endurance. It's exactly what God calls for us to have, is patient endurance, and nobody shows that better than Joseph here. He acknowledges God's hand at work. If we skip ahead to chapter 45, verse 7, this is after, because what's going to happen is after Joseph reveals those dreams, he's going to sit in prison for another 2 years. And then Pharaoh's going to have his own dreams. And the baker's going to, oh, wait a minute, that guy, I remember him now. So he's given that false sense of hope. Can you imagine how disappointing that was? He's thinking, 3 days, Pharaoh's going to find out about me. I'm out of here. It took 2 years and 3 days. Can you imagine the disappointment he would have felt and the abandonment he would have felt? But it doesn't tell us any of that. The reason I say it is because I know that's what I would have felt. But now, years later, he's interpreted Pharaoh's dreams. The famine has come through Egypt. And he's revealed himself to his brothers. And I know I skipped a whole lot of stuff here, but some of you guys want to get to the ark, so we got to get this going. But after he's revealed himself to his brothers, he says, God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and save your lives by great deliverance. Joseph is seeing that's where his patience paid off. God sent him ahead. He was the one that was to go ahead and pave the way for the rest of his family to come into Egypt. And they didn't even know this yet, but are ultimately going to become the birth of a nation. What Joseph sees it at is saving his family's lives. What God sees it at is preserving the family line to bring a whole nation about. Because what if that family had died in the famine? History would have gone a little bit differently. But the patience that Joseph showed. And then after he's finally revealed himself to his brothers, and this is years later, Jacob has died, what do his brothers do? And this is where we circle back to the scripture that we read at the beginning. Joseph looked at his brothers. His brothers are afraid of him. They were so afraid they sent messengers. They're like, we're going to put Operation Human Shield here, and we're going to find out if he's upset or not. We're going to send messengers to go talk to him. And what does Joseph say to them? Do not be afraid. Am I in the place of God? He's continually giving God credit for his circumstances here. And he says, as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. They intended to abandon him, to kill him, and to lie about it, to cover it up. But he said, God intended it for good in order to bring about, as it is this day, to save many people alive. So again, Joseph is seeing this as God using this for him saving his family. And sure, right there at that time, that's what it looked like. But now we have, again, remember we said we have that completed Bible. God did this to preserve a nation of people that still exists today. That's a big deal. It's a very, very big deal. And now we're going to circle back. Okay, so we have Romans 8:28 up here. We know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. And as I studied this, you know, I realized that as Christians, we take this out of context a lot. We say, what's that Newsboys song where they repeat over and over again, you make all things work together for our good? That's not what it says. That's not what it says. Don't take this out of context. It says, we know that all things work together for good to those who love God. That's the difference with Joseph here. He loved God. He trusted in God. He had that patience in God. And to those who are called according to his purpose. God has a calling for all of us. But if we don't answer it, he will move on without us. If we go to Romans 8:28, we see that there. But now, let's learn a little more about God's callings. They're irrevocable. That's what the Bible tells us, that God's calling is irrevocable. If he calls you to do something, it means he expects you to do it. He intends for you to do it. But if you don't listen, if you don't love him, if you don't follow that calling, he will move on without you. And that's a very sobering thought to think that your God will move on without you, because these things are still going to happen, but he wants you with him. He doesn't need you. He wants you with him. He wants us all to follow him along. It says, and can we get that verse from 2 Timothy back up on the screen? Who has saved us and called us with a holy calling, not according to our works, but according to his own purpose and grace, which was given to us in Christ Jesus before time began. God had a purpose for you before he even created you, before he created anything. The beginning of John, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Jesus was there. He had a purpose for you from the very beginning. Thousands of years before you were even thought of, he had a purpose for you, and he wants you to fulfill that purpose. So how do you fulfill that purpose? And it says that we have that. The Bible tells us we have that in our hearts. Romans 8:19 says, for the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly awaits for the revealing of the sons of God. It says, the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs for now. We have it in our hearts to chase after the purpose that God has for us. And Joseph knew that, and Joseph saw that, and that was why he was continually okay with his circumstances. People love to come up to us and say, whenever something bad's going on, they'll come up and say, it's okay, everything happens for a reason. Right? How often do we hear that from people? You get patted on the back, everything happens for a reason, it's okay. But that only applies if you're really listening to God, if you're really willing to follow him, and to just have that patient endurance, to be okay with your circumstances for right now, whatever they might be. We all go through that. I mean, we're a very close little fellowship here. We all know each other. We all know each other's circumstances. Just to share personally, I mean, my family got picked up and moved to Kentucky 3 years ago, and we're still not quite sure why. You know, but here we are, and this is where God has us right now, and I don't think we're going anywhere anytime soon, and this is where he has us, and it's just up to us to have that endurance, and it's not easy. It's really not. It's a huge challenge for a family to go through, but it galvanizes us. It brings us together. So how do you accomplish these things? How do you follow that? Well, again, so we said at the beginning, what do we have in common with Joseph? How can we relate to him? Well, there's two to three things that really jumped out to me here. It's, first of all, we're loved. Each of us is loved by God. Doesn't matter what's going on in our lives, we're all loved by God. And the second thing is that we are hated because we are loved. The world hates you because you're loved by God, because they see that. Look at the world we're in right now. I mean, think back to the last election season that we went through. The opposition was more afraid of an evangelical Christian than they were the president of Iran. Okay? We've got people that have missiles pointed at us with their finger on a button, but they're more afraid of an evangelical Christian. So what does that tell you about us? God is with us. He's with us, and he's with us with authority. So what do you ask yourself to get through these situations? Well, you got to ask yourself, what is God teaching me? What is God trying to tell me right now? What does he want me to learn from this time in my life, from these experiences? What is he teaching me? What can I do right now to serve him? Where am I right now in my life? What can I do to serve him, to glorify him, to take these circumstances and somehow give back to my God? And then look at 1 Corinthians 13, when we talk about the three Christian values. Do I have faith, and is my faith producing works? Do I have love in my heart, and is my love producing labor? And do I have a hope that inspires patience? And that's how we take it full circle, folks. That's how you get that patience. To take those circumstances, whatever they are in your life, and to do with them as Joseph did, to just go about your life and do what you do. To not look to your family, to not look to others to lay blame, to not look and say, woe is me, to not try and you know, swindle your way out of it somehow, but just to let the Lord lead you. That's what he's telling us here. And we're going to close with that today, that patience and that perfection of God's timing, because we saw it work for Joseph here, and many of us have seen it work in our lives, but we also might be at that spot right now where we're just waiting for God. Maybe your life is on hold right now a little bit, and that's okay. Maybe you're saying, God's not speaking to me. Well, and that's one of the things, we look at the Bible and we see, especially in Genesis and the early parts of it, we see God having these direct interactions with people. Well, Abraham is a great example. He lived to be 175 years old, but God only spoke to him a handful of times. And most of that was contained in about a 30-year period. He didn't wake up every day and go have his morning dialogue with God before he got started. God came to him at his own time, but it was, once every 5 years, maybe, if you stretch it out over a 30-year period, 5 or 6 times over that period of time. Just listen, because he is talking to you and he wants to give you that patience. Just listen, and your God is going to carry you through it. So we're going to go into a short time of prayer now. And Lord, that's what we ask you for today, is we ask you for that patience, for whatever it is that's happening with us right now, anything that we aren't happy with, anything that we don't understand, anything that's a hardship for us, a struggle for us, a challenge, an uphill battle, anything that's confusing to us, we just ask for patience and to sit and to look around and to see your hand at work and feel your hand at work, to hear your voice in our hearts, and to just carry us through. There's so much of it through this fellowship and through this world, and I just pray that we have that patience to carry one another through it as husbands and wives, as believers in this fellowship, as friends, as brothers and sisters, to bear each other's burdens and to give each other that strength and that patience that's required of us to just fulfill whatever it is your purpose is for us. And Lord, if anyone here wants to call out to you, now is the time. And just pray that you hear these prayers, Lord, and that you are with us and give us that direction that we need and that strength that we need to push forward and to press on.